welcome to High Noon, where we talk about controversial subjects with interesting people. I'm so pleased to have Helen Roy on today. Again, I love talking to Helen, and we've talked about a number of subjects in the past, but I wanted to have her on specifically to talk about an article that she wrote in The Blaze, which you can check out on that website, and it's called From Boom to Bust, The Truth About Millennial Malaise, although it is really about boomers. And yes, we're going to have the boomer conversation today. on the outset, I'll say, of course, my parents are boomers, right? Like, there are many boomers that we know and love. But I do think that you've hit on something in this piece about a kind of generation functioning as a firewall for, I don't know if it's the first time in human history, that might be an exaggeration, but certainly sort of in American history or in modern history, between the past and the world that we live in so many ways. And they really are that sort of firewall generation. So could you maybe lay out, there's a thesis of this article, but there's so many angles to it, but like just the top line thesis, and then we'll get into some of the specifics.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we won't be the first of younger generations to criticize our parents. There's a rich tradition of this but you can definitely trace it to eminent Victorians by Lytton Strachey. And Helen Andrews wrote a great book on the boomers where she sort of framed everything in these terms. But there is something, and Helen Andrews would say the same, that there is something sort of uniquely degenerate about the boomer generation, in the sense that they were handed a world that was pretty well functioning. I mean, I think that certainly the seeds of destruction would have been planted probably before they were even born. But there's a dramatic turnover that you can locate pretty much at the generation. And I do also want to echo what you said. Dad, I love you so much. You know, we talk every day. So there's nothing personal here. All of this is just general. We're talking about statistics.
Yeah, it's interesting because on, and we'll get to some of the specifics in your article in a minute about, I think, child raising and sort of millennials now being the generation that has young children and how they're relating to what is often their parents, boomers. And how their parents are relating to that experience. But there's what occurred to me is there's something very similar going on with the sexual revolution as well, where yeah. Essentially the boomers were the generation that completed the revolution.
Yeah.
But millennials, and I haven't forgotten about you, Gen X. I do think it's genuinely different because Gen X mostly had either older boomer parents or silent generation parents. Millennials, I think, were the first generation to grow up with the sexual revolution standards as the default.
Yeah, totally.
They were no longer rebellious. They weren't like, you know, they weren't exciting and new. That was, you know, the hookup culture was the default that millennials came of age into. Again, not to say that people did not have sex, casual sex included, before that. But I think I'm right to say that we were the first. I think you're a younger millennial, right?
Yeah, I think I'm technically zillennial. I was born in 95. And Jonathan Haidt says that 95 is the first Gen Z generation. And I don't know, maybe it's just because, you know, I moved out of the house when I was really young or something, but I've just always identified older. I've also looked 30 since I was 16. I just have that kind of face. But it's cool. I hope I'll just like look 30 forever. And I haven't aged since I was like 16, so it's fine. But yeah, I don't know what I am. I'm sort of liminal. Yeah.
Kind of face, like angular face.
Yes. Yeah. Slightly masculine, androgynous. I'm not being self-deprecating. It just is what it is.
No, but so you're a little younger than me. I'm like in the fat part of the millennial curve. I would say my parents are probably on the older side. They had me in their mid to late 30s. Mm. And also they're not from this country. So actually a lot of this doesn't apply, I think, to the culture my parents grew up in, but it's something I've very much observed. But yeah, like because we were the children, and this probably applies to the like younger part of Gen X as well. We were the children that were born after a whole bunch of these transformative cultural revolutions happened, not just in the United States, but to some extent across the world. All of those things had sort of been solidified. They had become normal. They had institutionalized in many ways. And I think that that is kind of what you're pointing to, at least in part in this piece. But what are some of the specifics that, what are some traits of boomer grandparents that you point out that seem, again, want to be clear, does not apply to everybody, seem unusual compared to grandparents of older generations?
So there, I tried to paint, you know, the piece that I started writing wasn't even about the boomers. It was about millennials, because we see on the right today, there's a whole lot of anxiety from all corners. Why aren't millennials having children? Why, you know, what's with this arrested development? Why aren't we sort of, you know, pressing go on these moments that define adulthood in a lot of ways. And so I started to just think about that try to get beyond the partisan representations of why that is. And so, you know, the left will often, and I think correctly, cite all of the economic headwinds that millennials have faced uniquely. The housing market is not what it was for our parents. That's just when it comes to, you know, wages versus the value of a home, and how much of your wages it takes to get into a home and put a down payment on a home. That is a totally novel situation. Well, not totally novel, once again, like history is long. But in terms of our recent history, you know, we're in a worse spot than our parents were. And then there was also the Great Recession. A lot of millennials, I think, graduated from college into a market that sort of cut them off at the knees. Another economic situation that I think is really, really key, and the left won't talk about this, only a few people on the right will talk about it, is the fact that men's jobs, specifically blue-collar jobs, have been automated and outsourced. And, you know, when it comes to fertility, certain facts about the genders kind of apply. Like, a woman wants a man to be able to provide for her children. And if men, once again, are getting sort of cut off at the knees in this way, and they're traditionally, in their traditional kind of ways that they could make money, then it's affecting their eligibility as potential husbands. So on the other side, the right tends to talk about culture. So we'll bring up casual sex and antinatalism and secularism and the diversionary urban lifestyle, sort of boil all of this down to like personal choice. And I think both of these things are true, by the way. Like, I don't mean to disparage either side. Like, everybody has points, right? It's not the family values culture that maybe it once was. And we don't have like a public Christian, explicitly Christian culture. There's actually nothing, there's not a universal ethos that would prevent somebody from just being a lotus eater and pleasure seeking for the rest of their life. And, you know, having kids is actually an affront to your freedom in certain ways. I mean, this is maybe not the most popular thing to say, but yeah, they do limit you in some ways. Now, that being said, I think they open you up in a lot of ways and create new worlds, and that's underestimated and it's beautiful. But in terms of like that atomized, individual life script, kids are an impediment to that. So anyway, so these are these two things that left and right are kind of constantly battling back and forth about, and rightly accusing the other of like insufficiently paying attention to the thing that they care about. I think many things can be true at once, and both of these things are true. But I noticed as I was thinking about this and writing this piece that like, not a lot of people are talking about actually the condition of the millennial heart. And I think about, you know, I think about a lot of my friends and just people I know and love who they feel it's not just that they're economically disabled or that they are, you know, like morally unclear and searching. It's that emotionally and socially they feel alone and abandoned and anxious. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that their parents got divorced. And that, I, for a lot of the people that I know whose parents got divorced, you know, they're crippled in a way that is hard to account for. So I wanted to account for that, and that's why I wrote this piece. So you asked me about like some of the particular statistics regarding grandparents and things. Divorce is going to play directly into that. So let's say that you have a millennial who is doing fine economically. He's doing well enough. He or she is doing well enough. And, you know, morally they want to have children. They're not just like, you know, chasing their next desire, unencumbered or whatever. Like they really want this in their life, but there are certain interpersonal things that I think are making this more difficult. Okay, first is going to be the dating situation. If you can't develop a strong relationship with a member of the opposite sex, you're not going to be able to have children naturally. And so boomers normalized no-fault divorce and they made marriage frivolous. And I think that the emotional fallout for that is something that we really are seeing in the dating world, with people being in these permanent monogamous relationships, but never wanting to take that leap because they're afraid of it falling apart. And so they just sort of push things constantly down the road, right? Okay. Anyway, back to the millennial who's ready. Let's say they can find somebody and they want to start having children. They have their first one. These divorced boomers are on other sides of the country. They're not living close to their kids. And they are, you know, as you have written before, spelunking, you know, into every crevice of their own psyche, trying to find themselves and doing the cruises. And not every boomer is like this, but it's enough to constitute a trend, I think. And so, yeah, I just think that there are a lot of factors playing into this. And then a really great statistician from London, his name is Post-Liberal Pete, he wrote about something called the grandmother effect, where he demonstrated that having a living maternal grandmother nearby increases the number of offspring born to those daughters by 20%. But the reverse is true. So if a grandmother is not present, if a maternal grandmother is not present, those women end up having many fewer children than they would have otherwise. Those women express that they, you know, they wish they had more support. And then the final thing about grandparents is something that Mary Harrington identified in a piece that she wrote about the so-called glammies, which are baby boomer grandmothers who seek to embrace their, quote, hot, kooky, unhinged grandma era, where they give their grandkids inappropriate things for breakfast and do crazy things with them. And they travel, they hop in and out. They're really not interested in changing diapers. So this is the sort of general picture of what's going on. Yeah, I hope that was a good explanation. It's kind of long-winded.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there, but let's start with the obvious sort of pushback, right? Because, you know, the answer from a lot of boomers will be, you know, millennials are spoiled. They think they're the first generation to have ever, you know, raised children. Until millennials have done it. And actually, I think the two generations, my own and boomers, I have similar critiques of both generations, in the sense they sort of these two huge population bulges in the American fabric. And we are definitely on our way to being the new boomers, right? Where, and I think you saw this changeover in the Super Bowl a few years ago, where we had like, you know, Dr. Dre on the Super Bowl halftime show. And it was like this cultural handoff. We have done the 60s, you know, music, film, everything. There's all these references culturally to the 60s up until now. And now it's going to be the 90s because millennials are in charge. Right? And so I think there's actually a lot of similarity, perhaps unsurprisingly, between these generations. So, but the pushback will be, you know, there's a lot that's going right. We are wealthier as a society than we used to be, although I do take a lot of the left's critiques on this, that it is harder to have a single income family now. Housing is at a premium comparatively to wages. It's definitely not as easy to, you know, get a, you know, 2 or 3 bedroom starter home somewhere around, you know, a major metropolis in a way that it was simply possible in the 1970s. And so there are a lot of, I take a lot of these critiques, but then, you know, there's the hyperbole millennials have it the worst that anyone's ever had. And obviously, you know, people had kids during the Great Depression. People had kids in Auschwitz, right? So like there is that trad counter of it's like, no, you're just valuing, you know, you're valuing what you choose to value in your life. And you're not poorer than many, many people have been in history. There are certain economic strictures on you, but at the end of the day, this is a cultural choice.
Yeah.
But where that rings much less true to me is in the first part of your explanation that it's about divorce. And there is no statistical doubt that boomers are the divorce generation.
Yeah.
They are the generation that completely normalized divorce. They have the highest divorce rates. They have higher divorce rates than Gen X, than millennials at the same period of time. Often what's happening with millennials and with younger generations, although, you know, Gen Z is only now getting to an age where we would expect them to start marrying in high numbers, but it looks like they're going to follow the same trends.
Yeah.
That they're simply not getting married to begin with. So the fact that divorce rates are dropping is out of a smaller percentage of people who are making this leap to begin with. But that does really strike me as true. That, and I see it in my own life and with my friends, that it has a much stronger impact on children's romantic future and their ability. Of course, nothing is determined, and plenty of people go on to have very happy marriages and commit to very happy marriages after their own parents failed in that regard. But that it has a huge impact, that essentially the modern Love New York Times line about if you're happy with your divorce and your children will be fine, and it's worse for them to see their parents fighting than it is for them to live and have separate houses and go back and forth, right? Well, what I've observed, and increasingly what I think you're pointing to in this piece that is really valuable and is not part of the discourse, as you say, either on left or on right, is the fact that such a large percentage of the millennial generation does not have and did not have stability at home.
Yeah.
Whether that's through divorce or being children out of wedlock, which was also exploded in the boomer generation for the first time in American history.
Yeah.
So, for the first time, this really is new. You know, lots of things happened before under the sun, but this in America really is new, to have the majority of children not grow up to age 18 under the same roof with their married mother and father. And I don't think you can underestimate the impact that has had. And somehow, until your piece, I basically did not see a single one of these "what are millennials doing? When are they going to grow up?" pieces from either left or right ever address the fact that we, as a generation, statistically speaking, we were not given that example.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, most times we were fatherless. That we were fatherless, and a fatherless home creates a motherless home in a certain sense, because when mom has to be mom and dad, she I think a lot of times loses that, loses a sort of like maternal softness and, just that, you know, the complementary piece that a mother would bring versus a father is kind of, can get lost. So like, no matter how you cut it, the kids of broken homes are missing their paternal and maternal role models in a really big way. You know, and I think in a lot of ways, like even like philosophically speaking, like what does it mean to be a good man? And what does it mean to be a good woman? I think that those are different answers, and they can pretty much be answered by the question, what does it mean to be a good father? And what does it mean to be a good mother? And, you know, that being said, like, I don't think people, I mean, if I'm going down like the philosophical route, I don't think people necessarily need to be, you know, physical mothers and physical biological mothers and fathers in order to be good men and good women. But, you know, there is something definitely informative about a paternal role and a paternal role model, and the same on the other side. And so these our generation, our peers were robbed. They were robbed. This is an injustice. I mean, really, it's like, I almost feel like the economic concerns and the moral concerns on the other side are sometimes just like, I don't know, ways that people are maybe like laundering that bigger point about injustice. It's like there's this sense that, like, you know, things are unfair. Well, especially on the economic side, there's a sense that things are unfair, and that's true in a certain sense. And you know, consumer goods are cheaper, but really important goods like education and healthcare and housing are way more expensive. So I don't know if that balances out, but the sense of injustice just remains, and I think that's where it's coming from.
I had Mary Eberstadt on a year and a half ago.
Love her.
Her book, Primal Screams, which
did
actually change the way that I looked at some of the fragility behavior of my generation and then the generation coming after, Gen Z. Really transformed some of my contempt into pity. That really, part of this fragility is not an act. And yes, part of it is parenting choices as well, in terms of like not allowing kids independence and not allowing them to test their boundaries. But a large part of it is not having the security in the family unit that was the norm for sure most of American history, most of Western history to a certain extent, especially like post-Christian Western history. And that's not a small thing. Like, that's not a small thing to have transformed the relationships between the sexes, the permanency or lack thereof of marriage. And to be clear, this is not, it's obviously the case that plenty of people had bad marriages before no-fault divorce became common and normalized. But from a lot of children's perspective, that was still a more stable situation than the one that a very large percentage of millennials grew up in. I was glad to read this because I thought, you know, it is such a huge overarching factor. And yet, as you say, we're either talking about the lack of adherence of millennials to trad values, which I talk about, you know, guilty, I talk about all the time, and I think is worrying. Or we're talking about millennials being the most economically screwed generation ever, which, as you say, there's some truth to, some not, right? And neither of those things have the full explanatory power. They're both true to some extent. But when I look around me at my friends and what had more of an impact on their decisions, for example, not to get married or to delay serious dating or to delay forming a family, a lot of it has been that they're worried about the fallout. They're worried about the collapse. They don't feel like sort of confident and stable and comfortable in relationships, or they seek to sort of fix certain elements of their own families and the way that they date, which can be its own problem. And look, I'm the last person to get sort of Freudian about any of this, or to get circumspect about the psychological impact. I'm very skeptical about psychology as a discipline. I'm especially skeptical about the way it's practiced today. But just on a fundamental animal level, we have a generation that a large percentage of which just did not learn, to use Mary Eberstadt's words, did not grow up in the normal human environment. Because the normal human environment was to have mother and father under one roof. Now, you know, we can talk about pre-Christian norms and the ancient world, and sometimes that was in a harem context. But still, like, what we have now and what the post-1960s world has looked like is different in this very fundamental way from the way that virtually every society has looked before. And there are a few, you know, sort of anthropological exceptions, but the vast majority of societies have not looked like this. And we are essentially two generations into an experiment that has never been run.
Right. Yeah, I think there's something really, really important about not giving up and not having giving up being an option. You know, as a Catholic, that's pretty written into our faith culture. It's like, we don't sign prenups because this is it, buddy. Like, you know, there is no divorce here. And that, you know, all of this has its downfalls, pitfalls, and problems. And you can always, always, always find somebody who's in a horrible abusive marriage and they should separate, you know? But I think one of the things that we've inherited from not just divorced parents specifically, although that too, but the culture of divorce is this attitude that giving up is okay. You know, I think I will also get psychological for just a second, even though I don't necessarily love to do that either. But I think that that introduces a baseline fragility that makes it impossible for people to have good relationships. Because if you can just cut and run, and if you really think it's okay, and if you in your mind you've rationalized and minimized all of the consequences of cutting and running, you know, that I think just psychologically does something to people that just makes them more flaky, and makes that, you know, in a certain sense, atomization is a revealed preference. You know, human beings, we kind of do have to force ourselves to recognize the goodness in community and to choose it and to actively choose it every day and pursue virtue in the context of a community. And I think divorce absolutely throws a knife into the heart of that community, into the most fundamental unit of that community. And it just makes everybody involved less capable of being a virtuous citizen, full stop.
I think it's interesting. You say like chosen, that it's a revealed preference, that atomization is a revealed preference. And I very much agree, because it is one of those things that we're realizing was really important about unchosen bonds. Now, marriage has never been in modern America an unchosen bond, right? But it had that element of lack of choice afterwards.
Yeah.
But the other bonds, the other community bonds, family bonds, to some extent, like obligations, interlocking obligations, those were not chosen. Those were duties that you were born with, and you had to honor. And yes, of course, there was some percentage, small percentage of people who didn't honor them, but that was very much discouraged and shamed in the larger community. And it turns out that when you give people the psychological option, as you say, to leave communities and to make it a choice, there is almost always a moment in all, just about everybody's life where that would be preferable, right? My parents have been married for a long time. And I know several other couples who are in their 70s or 80s and have been married since they were in their 20s. And I don't know a single couple that made it that long that did not have a time where, had they been given the choice between being with their spouse and not, they wouldn't have preferred to be not with them. I just don't know. I mean, I know that sounds like a very unromantic thing, but I have never experienced knowing a couple in their 70s that made it all that time without at some point preferring to be separate from each other. But the difference is they just didn't do it, right?
Yeah.
They lived through those periods in their life without splitting the marriages. But so you hit on in this piece, there's this one line that I just absolutely love because it adds this new element to what I think is really a kind of year zero project, which I don't say this in a at all in a positive way. I do not want to be a year zero project.
yeah.
I do think, especially those of us who see a lot of the problems that you're laying out that now are multi-generational, and see the impact in our generation and the decisions that we are choosing with our free will to continue doing, you know, there is this sort of restorationist impulse or this ability. We feel that we need to start somewhere and build up some community. I mean, I feel like at this point, left and right recognize what a problem atomization has become. And the solutions are different, just like the analysis for why we got here is different, but everybody recognizes it as a problem. And so we now find ourselves, people concerned about this, now find ourselves in this sort of building phase. And you have this great paragraph. So you say, what remains of a robust civic life are two options, extremely expensive, high demand private, or actually I'll get to that part in a minute. Let me skip ahead for a moment. If millennials want a village, they must build it themselves. The village in which they were born dissolved beneath their feet at the behest of their elders. All that remains is a terribly thin and tattered social fabric. Rebuilding everything from scratch is a pretty overwhelming prospect for an unprecedentedly mentally ill and lonely generation. Ultimately, the generation must exercise radical acceptance and responsibility in order to move forward. But so you're describing essentially a year zero project. So
yeah,
what are you seeing among your peers, your friends? How are people building this? Because I completely agree with you that, at least personally, but I know this is a generational observation because I see it all around me. And then of course we add to that with the statistics about, you know, family size, about divorced parents, about marriage or lack thereof and children or lack thereof. By the time millennials hit 45, we will have the highest percentage of women ever in American recorded history hitting 45 unmarried and childless. Mm-hmm. So given all of that, what are you seeing in your peer groups or in your circles that is an attempt to reconstruct something like a community that we really weren't bequeathed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I will start by talking about a role model of mine. Her name is Lane Scott. I had her on my podcast recently. And everybody go listen to that. But no, it was one of my favorite episodes, entitled The Absolute Necessity of Female Friendship. And Lane is, I think, maybe technically an elder millennial and or maybe early Gen X or late Gen X. But anyway, she has built a really beautiful and robust and insular Catholic, not she alone, but she and her friends together, beautiful, insular, robust Catholic community out in California where, you know, their kids are now, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating and they're eating the pudding and their kids are great. And their kids are grown and not everybody is perfect, but you know, that result, that end result of capable, happy, smart, and socially adept and economically not retarded kids is like, that's what we want, right? Because that's the thing that we feel like we, I don't know, we maybe squandered, or like we didn't become, that's the ideal that we didn't reach maybe. So she's built something really excellent. And in that episode, she really describes that and how much she and these other moms relied on each other for so many years, by taking matters into their own hands in every conceivable way, from education to building homes. I mean, they build furniture. And I'm not saying like that everything, like we have to do all of that. We have to like literally go to ground zero for every single thing and start like farming in the backyard. Although a lot of people are doing that too. And I have one, I did ask on Twitter, one of my most popular unpopular tweets is homesteading the millennial midlife crisis. That is a way that I think the millennials are trying to rediscover what it means to be human. By taking matters into their own hands and learning and developing a discipline and habits of life that are simple and straightforward and are definitely a boon to your mental health, but also create community in these ways. So anyway, Lane is a great model for that. Me personally, I'm just trying to do what she did, but I'm much far behind her. My kids are really little. However, I have amazing friends, just wonderful friend groups. And I work, I'm a stay-at-home mom who also works, but I structure my days around our community. So from 9 a.m. to noon every day, I'm doing something involved in building our little community of friends. And that's just how I prioritize it. And you can, I'm going to like shamelessly self-promote another time. I recently wrote a piece about that called The Art of Time Blocking, where I describe how I like get everything done in a day, but while also like prioritizing this very, very key component of a happy, good life from the Aristotelian perspective, which is community. So anyway, there are a lot of different things that people are doing. I think especially Catholic world is full of these people. I know a lot of Orthodox Jews are doing the same thing too. A lot of evangelical Protestants are doing the same thing. A lot of high church Anglicans are doing the same thing. It's really coming down to theological questions, and teleological questions. What are human beings for? And yeah, to the degree that millennials are answering this big, like, generation zero problem, they're answering it in that way, in very basic, that very basic, not basic, but fundamental kind of way. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, there's, I feel like people have forgotten that was a throwback in terms of a lot of the cultural and family formation stuff. So, you know, they remember the one or two kids in their whole school who had divorced parents. Like, it was notable. In my public school, I only had one other friend who didn't have divorced parents by the time I was in high school.
Yeah.
And just like on every, they also had more kids. Those families were bigger by my norm. My husband was one of only a handful of only kids, whereas my school it was not unusual at all for me to be an only child. I would say it was nearly evenly split between one and two kids in the households. And then the Jewish kids had three, right? Two for us, one for the tribe. The Jewish families, that was, you know,
the Jewish, is that a thing? Family. That's so funny.
You know, it was just a very, very different environment. And I look at how it, a lot of Jarrett's peers turned out. And like every one of those ills that we take for granted, especially in the working classes of America, is so much lessened in the graduates of those schools. Now, not because they all went off to do some, you know, very lucrative thing, or they all, you know, they conquered the world, but most of them are married. Most of them have, you know, several kids. There isn't a lot of divorce in that generation either. They all work steady jobs. A lot of the girls, the women stay home, right? Even though it's difficult to do in the Bay Area, but some of the women work as well. But they hold normal jobs, 9 to 5, 9 to 6, right? They put food on the table and they have these stable families, and there's much less catastrophic drug use that has become the hallmark of sort of, the white working class in America, right? The deaths of despair are not happening. And I'm not at all like saying that their lives are perfect, or that they don't have problems, they don't have relationship problems, things don't happen, like that they don't have stresses in their lives, but that fragility and that constant anxiety doesn't exist on nearly the same level in that cohort. And it really is kind of a control group. Like, you can raise people in the modern world who are not insane.
Yeah.
At least as a baseline.
Right? Yeah.
Maybe life will make you insane at some point.
For sure.
But you can have kind of stability as a baseline. Before we wrap up here, I want to talk about the role of institutions, because there is this dual thing, and you do point to this in your piece, right? If we're the generation zero on a lot of these things, we didn't inherit the village. We're trying to build it in various ways. There's this huge barrier to that as well, and this very like big isolating iceberg, which is the fact that the institutions have completely been corrupted and collapsed.
Right.
It is no longer, and I think since 2020, that's become clear to the vast majority of parents, the number of places that you can now trust to send your child to interact with other children, to meet other families, is small. And you cannot trust the local public school the way that it was possible in 1970, it was possible for parents to do that, right, for the most part. You can no longer trust a local library because everything is so ideological and aimed specifically at children. And it comes to institutions for adults as well, right? We have the collapse of civic clubs, for example.
Yeah.
And something actually that the boomers didn't destroy, this is all on us. The boomers are the last generation that are going to the Elk Club. Right. And so you have the collapse of civic clubs, the collapse of attendance. You mentioned, you know, 18 different denominations for religion, the collapse in church attendance that did start with the boomer generation that continued through their children, Gen X and then millennials. So like all of these institutions are either foreign to us or are so untrustworthy as to not perform the kind of communal function that they once performed. And that makes doing what your friend Lane is attempting to do much, much more difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Where do you find your people? Where do you find your little tribe of relatively like-minded people who are concerned about a lot of these trends and want to reverse them? You know, I think a lot of people in our generation feel lost about that, myself included, feel unable to rely not just on an inherited village in the sort of personal or family sense, but we can't even rely on the basic institutions anymore. Yeah. They're all like turned inside out and teaching that men and women are identical.
Yeah. And also just, I mean, that would include like public transportation. You cannot rely on anymore. And I'm not even talking about the trains running on time. I'm talking about people pushing you in front of them. It's it's disappointing and it's sad. And I think we have to acknowledge this and be honest about it and add it to the litany of things that are going to make life hard for a generation that has to build from nothing. But maybe this is just a personality thing for me. But I think that complaining is pretty useless. I mean, I think acknowledging legitimate injuries and addressing them is a matter of justice, and that needs to happen. But I think there's this tendency, especially online, right and left, to find your pet explanation for why things are the way that they are and just sort of rely on that as an explanation for why you aren't where you want to be. And not you personally, you generally, obviously. but I don't have an answer for the public institutions. You know, I mean, I feel like that has to be left to the politicians. Bukele is doing a great job with that. We need to imprison a lot more people. And maybe that includes people who are like pushing pornography toward third graders. I don't know. That's another question. But I think just personally, once you see a problem in the world, and if you have the ability to see through it and to understand it and to identify what's wrong, it immediately becomes incumbent upon you to take action in your own life to try to remediate, to try to fix the problem, you know? So like, yeah, this is not, I don't know. I kind of like don't have a political answer to this anymore. It's just all kind of personal. But that's powerful because these personal, I mean, it was a personal decision for Lane when she recognized, when she, you know, had her conversion and recognized what was good in life. The act of recognizing what's good in life, that necessarily, if you're a logically consistent person, that means that you have to act on that. Like, we've separated, I don't know, in the modern world, maybe like a recognition from what is good from the duty of acting that way. And so, yeah, I just think that like when it comes to this question, maybe, okay, what we can ask. And I wouldn't have written this piece if I didn't think it was really important to identify, hey, maybe this is why things are the way that they are. But then what does that mean for us personally? What does that mean for our duties in life? It means that we have a duty to forge and maintain excellent marriages. It means we have a duty to our children that we have to take more seriously than our forebears, to show them how to live. And there's always the danger of sort of overcorrecting, and you know, that's kind of a different conversation. I think honestly, a lot of times in these like trad religious movements, there's an amount of overcorrection that becomes toxic in its own way, for sure. But leaving that aside, I just think the answer is just to, like, if there is, like, I was talking to a guy recently who was, he was complaining about the way that the world is unfair for men. And he was like, well, yeah, as a divorced man, like, you have nowhere to go. You have no one to talk to. And I just said, okay, you are smart enough to recognize that that's true. So you need to lead. You need to, as trite as this sounds, be the change that you want to see in the world. Make a friend, find it, and try, and keep trying, and fail, and keep failing. But just like engage in the Sisyphean task of being a good citizen. That's just what has to be done. You just, I don't think there's more to it than that. Really, it's for the people who can see clearly. That is a grace, and we have to accept that grace and apply it.
Yeah. Just before we wrap up, I want to ask you a related final question, which is, you know, what does the world that you want to give your children in this year zero regard look like? And how are you hoping to give them perhaps what was absent in a statistical way across the millennial generation? And what are you hoping that those sacrifices and those things gives to them that perhaps our generation didn't have as a matter of course?
I want to offer them a vision of unity between the sexes that I think is increasingly rare, and that their peer group is not going to have, and that our generation did not have either. Like a vision of truly complementary, mutually respectful, and loving sacrifice. That's primary. I'd love for them to be part of a community where they have their pick of eligible spouses. I trust that my friends are going to raise great young men and women, and I would love for my children to be able to have people that they know that can be relied upon to marry. That sounds kind of crazy, maybe. But I mean it. I don't want them to have to go to hell and back to find the one person by some mysterious chance, you know, off a million miles away from home. It would be great if my kids could stay close. Now, that being said, they're going to have their God-given talents and their lives and their vocations, and that could mean a lot. Okay. But just in terms of what I can provide them. Yeah. I think it would be that vision of marital bliss, but sincere and, real, like ups and downs, but stability. And then also like such a solid group of friends that they won't feel like a lot of people in small town America might feel, which is that there's like something essentially missing that they can't get in the big city, you know, just like an educationally, culturally, and socially robust environment where they can thrive.
Well, on that note, Helen Roy, thank you so much for coming on High Noon. Could you let people know, besides The Blaze, where people can find you? What's the name of your podcast? All that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Inez. I really love that you liked this piece, because you actually inspired it in a lot of ways. So I'm Helen Roy. I host a podcast called Girl Boss Interrupted, which is about womanhood in the modern world. And I write Ladies Late Rome Journal on Substack, which is a mix of cultural commentary and also practical guides, things that I have learned in my journey that I think can help, especially new moms or new wives, people who are hoping to build the kind of community that I have just talked about here.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Helen. I really recommend that people read this piece at The Blaze, and then read your other work. I think it's very, it's almost anthropological in a way, but it's a sort of auto anthropology that we're doing here.
Yeah.
Which I guess is very much in line with the stereotypes, you know, again, crashing the boomers, very much in line with the stereotypes.
Yes.
Of millennials as being completely narcissistic and self-absorbed.
We're doing so true.
A modern anthropology of generations. Check out Helen Roy on Twitter and on her Substack and read her work. So thanks so much, Helen, for coming on.
Thanks, Inez.
And thank you to our listeners. High Noon with Inez Stepman is a production of the Independent Women's Forum. As always, you can send comments and questions to inez.stepman@iwf.org. Please help us out by hitting the subscribe button and leaving us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Google Play, YouTube, or iwf.org. Be brave, and we'll see you next time on High Noon.